Hi everyone. Welcome back to the Psych Mic podcast. I'm your host today. My name is Hannah. I'm a first year undergrad student studying psychology and neuroscience. And with me, I have Scott.
Hey guys, I'm also a first year student. I'm planning on going into clinical or organizational psychology. Happy to be here.
And today we have a very special podcast with a very special guest, Dr. Chris Groot. So hi, please welcome and introduce yourself.
Hi, Hannah. Hi, Scott. And hello, everyone out there listening. Very happy to be here to talk with you today. I am a lecturer in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne, and I run a lab here that focuses on work around stigma about mental illness, and in particular, more severe and complex forms of mental illness like schizophrenia. And we drive a range of research and teaching and public engagement work that aims to understand and address stigma.
We will get more into your work in stigma in just a bit, but I think we'd like to start off with something that's kind of broad. Scott and I are both MBBT students, so yeah, and he has like a question.
I guess my first question, and what I guess wondering about is, what's one thing that you'd like to communicate across MBB students about how the subject is run? Something that maybe they misunderstand or something they complain about and just don't understand why it can't really be changed.
Oh, something that people might not understand regarding the way it is, the way things, and how things might not be able to change. Well, interestingly, I suppose every student will have a unique perspective on MBB2 and their experiences and their expectations. One of the things that might be interesting for listeners to hear about is that MBB2 and MBB1 are areas of the teaching program that I've been involved with for a very long time. And the subject, as you experience it today, this semester, it's built on a long, long history of testing ideas and testing different ways of delivering content, of designing practical classes, of designing assessments. I started teaching in MBB2 as the head tutor, which is now a lecturer's role. And I started in 2007 in that role. And that was the year that I started my PhD. So I did my honors degree in psychology here. Indeed, you're all being lectured by Nick Haslam right now. And back when I was a student, he was also one of my lecturers in that honors year.
Oh, that's yeah.
And there are some really long-term staff that have been involved with the first-year program. So since 2007, I've worked continuously on the first-year program in a range of ways. And everything, things have developed just really meaningfully. And in quite large ways over that time. So, for example, when I started in 2007, one of my main jobs was to teach the tutors how to teach the research methods program. There would be no research methods modules. All of the research methods content was taught in practical classes. And so the majority of the practical classes were about learning statistics back then. And it was very focused on the stats and the maths. And what we learned was that focusing on the maths and the stats seemed to create quite a bit of anxiety in students, and that it was quite scary. And in some ways, it was turning some students away from psychology because it was just too confronting. And we also realized over time that there wasn't enough time then in the practical classes for students to have really enriching discussions and exploration of the remainder of the course. And so we've tried to, over time, open up more opportunities for that. We then went into a phase where, for a few years, I was doing lectures on research methods and sort of balancing that with fewer practical classes. But it ended up being the case that it just worked out better to transition to those micro lecture, micro module sort of approaches to chunk things into hopefully reasonably accessible classes with a focus more on the concepts, so that hopefully that's a little bit of a little bit accessible and a little bit less confronting.
I feel like if I might just say, I think it's great. Like last semester, I think it was just so straightforward because this is also my first time kind of learning these research methods modules. And like if my practical classes was just all on stats, I would have been a bit turned away because I'm not that big into stats. And I think it would have been a bit overwhelming. I don't know if Scott could say the same, but I think the way it's run now is pretty straightforward and good.
I mean, I do think it's also pretty good. I guess like a follow-up then would be, do you find that teaching it in this way, students when they get to second and third year then find the stats a bit more confronting? Or do you find that there's been a good pathway, a good way to transition into that heavy? Because it's kind of necessary for psychology, right?
It's very necessary for psychology, that's right. At some point, it's going to be confronting for students, particularly those who don't have a strong mathematics background before coming to study psychology. And it's interesting to he that question, Scott, because one of the things I'm looking at the moment for next year's modules is how we can tweak them to introduce some calculations back and represent some of the computational work a little bit more than is represented right now, but to do so in a very accessible way. And one of the ways that one of the things I'm looking at is how we can leverage AI in helping students to work through some problems and to explore some of those computational aspects of the work that have been historically quite confronting. So watch this space. Things might tweak a little for next year. And you mentioned the other years, second and third year, and I think this is something that students might also not know. And that is that it's all what we do in our curricula is very coordinated, and we have meetings every year. So all the stats folk who teach stats in the different year levels and different subjects, we all get together and we make decisions about what's going to be where in the program. We're using JASP because that was a group decision to use that as a user-friendly way to get introduced to statistical software in the first year. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes to make these curricular scaffold well and support students to incrementally develop their knowledge and skills in any of the areas that, obviously psychology is a very diverse area. So what goes, here for research methods also extends to personality psychology, social, the clinical stuff. I happen to oversee all of the undergraduate stuff, so that's useful. I coordinate with myself. Developmental and so forth. It's all very well mapped out. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. In fact, maybe one thing that might be interesting for listeners to hear about, given that assignments have just been released, is how much work actually goes on behind the scenes to get to yesterday. And to give you a somewhat com more a reasonably complete narrative, it's the work on yesterday's assignment release started maybe a month before semester started,
Like
and
before
it
semester started.
before semester started, and that's the point at which myself and Beth Hoburn, who's the associate subject coordinator, and Electra Schubert, and Lindsay, I think that's probably all of us got together as a subject and tutor leadership team to look at the assignment and the marking criteria and decide, based on what we know from last year, what do we need to implement? What were some of the problems that we might have experienced last year? And how can we streamline the assignment and the marking criteria and the rubric to support tutors to give the most rich feedback they can in the amount of time that they have available to mark the assignments? So, of course, it's a job for them. They get paid, a certain rate of payment per assignment. And so they need to fit that in, and so it needs to be feasible. And so that's a challenge. I would like to have way more assessment criteria and way more feedback coming into the assignments and be able to pay tutors, 2 hours to mark every assignment. But that's just not economically feasible. And so there's a challenge about how do you refine it and get that balance right. And then once we had that, and we decided what the criteria were going to be, then all the way through semester, so every Friday we have a tutor briefing, goes for 2 hours every Friday, 11 till 1. And that's where we brief the tutors on what's coming up in the next class, that they need to learn to teach. And also, in every one of those meetings, we picked out a couple of the assignment marking criteria, and we went through a benchmarking process, a process to improve the inter-rater reliability, to make sure everybody marks the same and assesses in the same way to the same level and so forth. And so all the way through semester, that was happening every week. And then on the day that the assignment deadline was, we had a big marking meeting where tutors would mark the same assignments and all calibrate in and make sure everybody's writing the same way, commenting the same way. Everything is exactly how we want it to be. We knew what the distribution of marks was going to be before we even started, based on the calibration process, last year's marks, and so forth. And that's very important. We want to ensure, and we have to ensure, that our marking is consistent year in, year out, to make it fair for students when they go to apply for, say, honours, that students who were in this year level aren't advantaged compared to students who were in, MBB2 in 2023 or 2022, and so forth. It all has to be consistent.
That's good. I never really thought about that, like in terms of like making the markings fair throughout different cohorts. Because I know that there's many different tutors, and like each tutor has to grade a certain amount of students. But kind of going back on the idea of honors, I kind of wanted to ask about what you did for your honors. You were doing it back in Uni Melb.
So my honors thesis was focused on auditory processing. So back then I was very and still am very interested in cognitive psychology and sensation and perception. And my honors degree was looking at how visual speech, so being able to see somebody speaking, and that amplitude-based aspect of sound, the loudness-based aspect of sound, and the frequency-based aspect of sound, so the tones and so forth, how they all interacted to support how well we can understand speech.
I see.
And so the first paper I wrote was about this and about how, theoretically what we'd found around the usefulness of amplitude and frequency modulations in speech and visual speech could be used in like areas like cochlear ear implants and this sort of thing. But this got me really interested in audition and in auditory processing. And towards the end of my honours year, I couldn't quite decide what I wanted to do. I knew I was really interested in clinical psychology. But I knew I was really interested in this audition research. And I was lucky enough when I was an undergrad student to do a placement all the way throughout my undergrad in a psychiatric facility.
Did you do that since your first year, or wow, so 3 years of this facility?
Exactly. And so this in a funny way came about because the placement that I did was focused on behavioral modification for people who were long-term inpatients, had been living in the facility for more than a year, for example, and could benefit from support in developing new adaptive ways of engaging socially, functionally, in terms of looking after themselves, cooking meals, and this sort of thing, waking up, doing things around self-care and long story short, this opportunity came up for me because I'd spent the previous, this was not my first career. My first career was as a marine mammal trainer, and I'd spent a decade getting pretty good at behavior modification.
With animals?
Predominantly seals more than anything else. So all sorts of animals, but seals were the animal that I worked with more than anything else. So still occasionally I'll go and assess for Melbourne Zoo if there's a stranded seal, go and assess what's wrong with it and let them know what should happen. But during that placement, I became very interested in when people were hallucinating, and particularly hearing voices. I thought, wow, that is just such an incredible experience that the brain can generate. And so in my honors degree, then at the end of it, Simon Cropper, who you may or may not have been lectured by yet, who still lectures in the department, set this assignment in honors, which I think still might be his assignment in honors. And it was now picture this. This is second semester in honors. You've got a group of, and it was a smaller program then. So I think we had a group of like, 40-ish sort of students. There was no other pathways back then about, masters of applied psychology and masters of professional psychology. It was all very super competitive. And so everybody's wanting the marks, for the next step. And Simon's assignment was write about whatever you like and hand in a mixtape.
Oh, this is for honors.
Yeah. And so, what originally you can imagine the anxiety that then created about what do you mean? Well, there isn't, we've no marking criteria. But it was brilliant because it's where I formed the idea for my PhD, to look at how dysfunctional auditory processing drives the experience of, or contributes to the experience of auditory verbal hallucinations and psychosis. And so that was what my PhD ended up being about. Very much because I had experienced something in placement that I thought was fascinating. And then, it had combined, done some research that was complementary. And then the beautiful thing about a PhD, is that you get to do what you want and you get to, maybe combine interests. And I think it's very common for psychology students that you're interested in more than just one thing.
Definitely. So how did, your research on like auditory and schizophrenia and hallucinations, how did that eventually lead to what you're doing right now and kind of what you're gonna do in the future in terms of your own research?
Yeah, good question. So, strangely enough, the first poster that I presented at a conference, at a schizophrenia conference, was about one of my first PhD studies. And we pulled out some data that demonstrated that there was a relationship between voice hearing and self-esteem, but a negative relationship. So people who were hearing more frequent and severe voices had lower self-esteem. And we wondered, we theorized in this poster about what this might have been about, and we talked about the idea of stigma. And some of the qualitative data that we'd collected was indicating that people were saying, so these were people living with schizophrenia who we had interviewed, and they were saying that, there's so much about their experience that they could explain as, quirky parts of their personality, for example. But the hearing voices part, that was the thing that culture really told them meant that they were crazy, they were mad, that they were, insert one of the other pejorative sort of terms in here. And that had influenced the way in which they felt about themselves because of their experience. So that was not at all the focus of my PhD, but I suppose that set the scene for me to be thinking about stigma. And the more that I spent time with people living with psychosis, the more I just became really aware that, wow, these people are really stigmatized and really feeling marginalized. This is a problem. But it wasn't necessarily a research interest of mine. I was far more interested, my PhD was technical in neuropsychiatry, and I was much more interested in the really detailed neurocognitive mechanisms of hallucination. And then when I started full time in the department, I had to come up with a research topic for a capstone class that I was going to be leading.
That's the third year class, right? For
Sorry?
is Capstone the third year class
Yeah,
for
that's right. That's right. And so one of the things we do is, give students an opportunity to run a research project. And I was trying to think of, well, what's an opportunity? And I came across a study that was arguing that relabeling schizophrenia should decrease stigma. And I thought, oh, well, that's a really interesting idea. And I noticed that this review paper that was arguing for this didn't actually present any experimental evidence. It was just sort of arguing for this as a principal position. And I thought, well, that's a pretty easy concept to interrogate experimentally. And that's how it started. So it actually started for me related to teaching, coming up with a teaching project.
I see. And do you have any any fields, or are you going to kind of stay in stigma for your current, your research in the future? Like, do you have any ideas? Do you think you ever, kind of divert your research into something completely new, or are you going to look more into like a specific mental health disorder that's not schizophrenia?
So I have done research in a range of areas of mental health that stigma is related to. With the National Stigma Report Card, we basically looked at the spectrum of severe and complex mental health problems that
Yes.
stigma pertains to. With a global project that we're getting up and running at the moment, we're really going to be looking at the spectrum of mental health problems and addiction as well, making sure that alcohol and other drug problems are in there as well. That's quite commonly neglected in stigma research. I think for the most part, stigma is going to be my central research stream. It's the thing that I've just become more and more involved with now, to the point where I'm advising governments, and it's opened up some really amazing connections. There's a great global stigma community that's reasonably small, but a
Yes.
great group of people to be involved with. But this year, I've speaking of governments, I've had the opportunity to work with the Scottish government, giving them advice there. The Korean government, worked with the World Bank, the Australian government in recent years. Right now, we've just started. With the Queensland government, the Queensland Mental Health Commission. We've just started about a month ago designing the stigma strategy for the state of Queensland. So there's really some tantalizing opportunities to use that research experience to do some good, to influence good for the public. So I think, yeah, this will be my mainstream. My mainstream of research for a long time to come, although I still do have a side stream of hallucination research that's sitting there on the back burner, and that's a little bit out of this world, shall we say.
I remember in one of the lectures you were saying that you went to some stigma conference. Is that what was that about? I was just kind of interested myself, but
I've been to a lot of them. So
oh,
it might
okay. Yeah,
have.
I think it was during like the clinical psych lectures, and you were just like, I need to rush off to a stigma conference. I just remembered that. But since you've been to a couple, I didn't even know that you were kind of helping out different governments with that.
Oh, right. Yes. So there was a speaking. Yeah. Okay. So that particular one, I was going to give a keynote address at a conference that was looking at health system transformation, how to reform and improve health systems. And I was giving a talk about how stigma is a problem in health systems, stigma about mental illness, and how to address that in terms of what does the evidence say regarding how to reduce stigma in mental health systems. Some particular types of presentations and disorders can be quite stigmatized, relatively speaking, in health system settings.
Yes.
And in different types of health system settings, and in different types of health professionals, and so that talk was, really talking about, well, what do we need to do with our health professionals and our health systems to really adequately resource and support those, and educate and upskill those professionals, and optimize those systems such that they're not breeding grounds for stigma when really challenging presentations maybe stretch resources and people's ability to respond in optimal ways.
Thanks for explaining that. I feel like I was just pretty curious because you briefly mentioned it. I was like, I want to know more about that. But thank you so much for just explaining, kind of your pathway to how you got to where you are in research. I think that's
Sure.
really helpful for for a first year student to kind of know. I'm still debating whether or not I want to get into research in the future. And I think it's nice to know that you don't need to know what you want to get into in terms of what you want to
Oh,
research.
that's so true. Yeah. You're going to encounter so many interesting things. The very first thing that I really latched onto was neuropsychology. I thought, oh, wow, that is fascinating. I want to be a neuropsychologist. And it wasn't until in third, fourth year? Fourth year? Fourth year. Yeah. So in fourth year, I got a job doing again some behavioral rehabilitation, but this time with through the Traffic Accident Commission in Victoria with people who had experienced neuropsychological injuries. And I didn't like the work. When I experienced the work, I realized that, oh, this is not what I was hoping it was going to be. And I also realized that in comparison from my other placement experience, that I was much more interested in the clinical than the neuro. But still academically very interested in the brain, and cognition, and so that sort of came out in my research. So yes, my advice would be just to be open to all of the new possibilities and to take your time and to take it all in, and who knows where it all leads. I mean, and I'm living proof, I suppose, that even when it comes to the PhD, it really doesn't matter what you specifically study. What you're doing is developing skills, research skills and academic skills and knowledge that you can bring to bear on any topic of interest in the future that you might end up working in.
Definitely.
In the interest then for future potential stigma researchers or I guess people interested in the field in general, before we wrap up really quick, I kind of wanted to ask Chris, if you had, I guess, one, what you think is most interesting about stigma research that pulls you to it? And two, if you could just tell any listeners out there one thing about stigma, if you could get one thing across, what would that be?
Like one important message about the work you've been doing that you,
What is an interesting thing about stigma research? We have some great stigma research in Australia. There is, again, a small group of people, but a group of people who have done really incredible, high quality, influential work. We have created a network of researchers to bring us all together and create a community and to create awareness of what we're each doing. We all came together a few years ago around the development of the National Stigma and Discrimination Reduction Strategy. And, just a collection of incredible people who have done incredible work again, who all contributed to the development of this strategy that was built on incredibly compelling evidence. People like Nikki Reevely, Amy Morgan, and others have taken repeated measurements of, for example, stigmatized attitudes in Australia towards a range of disorders over time. And we know, there's really compelling evidence that it's such a key problem. And it's always going to be a problem. We need to keep up the pressure of the work on stigma reduction to
Yes.
counteract it. Ongoing is the solution. And so we all came together around this national strategy, and we developed the national strategy through the National Mental Health Commission, and it was delivered to the government nearly 18 months ago now. But it's still not published.
Oh.
And there are, I think, political reasons for this, probably. We don't know why. But right now, sitting on the shelf in Canberra is a
Big. Yeah.
completed national stigma and discrimination reduction strategy, which outlines the roadmap to reduce stigma and discrimination for the country,
Yes.
not seeing the light of day.
Not much.
So I hope that we see that soon. So many
Yes.
people, researchers, professionals, people with lived experience gave so much to the development of that. And so I do hope, particularly as I said, we've just started with Queensland recently,
Yeah.
to be able to drive stigma reduction for the country. I hope we see that published soon. And I think the one thing to know for that people could take home, I guess, related to that is this will be an ongoing problem. Mental illness
Yes.
has been stigmatized as long as we know. We can look back at ancient Mesopotamian texts and see in cuneiform tablets signals of stigma and discrimination. This problem's not going away, so it's a battle that will always be there.
Yeah.
And if students are interested in working in this space,
Yes.
there's more than enough stigma to go around for everybody to be involved with research and advocacy and so forth.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Dr. Group. We really appreciate you here, and I think it's very insightful to just hear your entire pathway and how MBB2 has developed as a subject, and even now what you're currently doing with your research on stigma. I find that very, very insightful and very, very interesting. And yeah, I think it would be really nice for other first year students or anyone who's listening to kind of hear what you've been through and how you've got to where you are right now. And we just want to thank you for coming on again. And yeah.
My absolute pleasure. I'm a big fan of Moopa. Some of my happiest memories from my undergrad experience are from being part of the Psychology Student Association. And so, yeah, big fan of Moopa. Love what you guys are doing and keep it up.
Thank you so much. And yeah, thank you everyone for listening to this episode of Psych Mike, and we hope you enjoy and have a great week.